Coming up on Philosophy Talk, what books should thoughtful people read this summer?
Here are some ideas.
Wittgenstein's philosophy fascinates me.
Lars Eyer, author of Wittgenstein Jr., a novel.
But for me, even more interesting would be to bring Wittgenstein into the present-day university, into a contemporary context, and to see what happens.
We're doing the same thing. We're still trying to lead the examined life.
Poet Jane Hirschfield, author of 10 Windows, How Great Poems Transform the World.
Poetry is always doing it with a certain fidelity to the particular rather than the general, the lived rather than the abstract.
Sometimes love just lasts 2 minutes.
Britt Brogard, author of Unromantic Love.
It doesn't have to be long-lasting. In fact, I'm a little doubtful that love can last if it's romantic.
What will you read this summer to expand your mind?
It's our 10th annual summer reading list.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin on the Stanford campus at Philosopher's Corner. That's where Ken and I spend our summers doing philosophy.
Today, our 10th annual summer reading show.
10 years of compiling philosophical summer reading lists, thought-provoking books for thoughtful people. As is our custom, we've enlisted the help of our listeners and of some special guests.
Including Jane Hirschfield. She's an award-winning poet. She was our guest a few years ago for our episode Poetry as a Way of Knowing. Jane's got a couple of new books out herself this year. We'll ask her about them, but we'll also hear from her some recommendations for other poetry that you might enjoy reading this summer.
Summer's a great time to fall in love, but whether you're lucky in love or not, it's also a great time to read about the philosophy of love. Britt Brogard from the University of Miami joins us to talk about her new book, On Romantic Love, and to offer suggestions for other titles to explore.
Summer is also novel reading time for many people, and this being Philosophy Talk, we especially like novels with philosophical themes. So, we'll talk to Lars Eyer from Newcastle University. His latest book is called Wittgenstein Jr., a novel.
And to get us started, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shuka Kalantari, to ask people for samples of novels they hold close to their hearts. She files this report.
All that you touch, you change. All that you change, changes you. The only lasting truth is change. God is change. Octavia Butler, Parable of the Sower.
Love is like the sea. It's a moving thing, but still and all. It takes its shape from the shore it meets, and it's different with every shore. Zora Neale Hurston, Their Eyes Are Watching God.
No matter where you go, no matter what you touch, there is cancer and syphilis. It is written in the sky. It flames and dances like an evil portent. It has eaten into our souls, and we are nothing but a dead thing like the moon. Tropic of Cancer, Henry Miller.
What room is there for love in such proud hearts? Love bows head, gently, compassionately. Camus, The Just Assassins.
The first of the line is tied to a tree, and the last is being eaten by ants. Gabriel Garcia Marquez, 100 Years of Solitude. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
Thanks, Shuka. My favorite line, Ken, is not very sophisticated, I'm afraid. Mike Hammer was asleep when he heard the knock on the door. I'm John Perry, along with Ken Taylor, my fellow philosopher from Stanford University.
Today, we're putting together our annual summer reading list.
We're joined now by Lars Eyer. He teaches creative writing at Newcastle University. He's the author of 4 philosophically rich works of fiction, including his latest, Wittgenstein Jr., a novel.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Lars.
Hello. Thank you for having me on.
Hey, so I've been reading your really intriguing novel. And when I was first reading this, it's very philosophical. We're getting into Wittgenstein's mind, Wittgenstein Jr.'s mind. It's not really Wittgenstein, but the students call him Wittgenstein Jr. And I'm thinking, Like, Kierkegaard wrote stuff like this. There were fictional characters. There was a voice of a narrator who was trying to figure out Abraham and what Abraham could be thinking. And then there were these presentations. Why is this a novel rather than, like, Kierkegaard called Fear and Trembling, a philosophical lyric? What distinguishes a novel from, like, something like a philosophical lyric?
Well, it's for others to judge, I suppose, as to whether this might be a philosophical lyric. The comparison with Kierkegaard is very flattering. I mean, what's more wonderful to be put in the same category as someone who writes via this indirect communication, doing philosophy through, well, through a kind of literature. And Kierkegaard's fascinating in the way in which he does philosophy through his various pseudonyms, exploring various fictional forms in order to put his ideas across. And for me, I suppose that's something which lay behind my novel, in that Wittgenstein's philosophy fascinates me. It's a wonderfully interesting endeavour in philosophy. But for me, even more interesting would be to bring Wittgenstein into the present day, to bring Wittgenstein into the present day university. And that's what I've done in this novel. Wittgenstein Jr. is the title of the novel. And as you say, it's the nickname the characters, the young students, give to the young German thinker who arrives in their midst. So it's really my attempt to introduce Wittgenstein, this fascinating character, into a contemporary context and to see what happens.
So Lars Wittgenstein Jr. has similarities with Wittgenstein, but there were kind of a lot of different periods in Wittgenstein's life. There was the young student of Russell's, the tractarian, very enigmatic and terse. Then the investigations, kind of rambling and all over the map. Which Wittgenstein is this?
Well, my attempt was to try to bring together the various phases of Wittgenstein's career, the real Wittgenstein. And the way I did this was to have my character Wittgenstein Jr. pursuing what is, at the beginning of the novel, the real Wittgenstein's early philosophy. And as the novel moves on, he turns to writing his version of Wittgenstein, the real Wittgenstein's later philosophy. And one of the things that complicates this slightly is that my character, Wittgenstein Jr., had a brother who killed himself. And this brother is very much modelled on the real Wittgenstein in his early period.
Right. But let me ask you another question. I'm going to put you back in a moment before you launch this novel. And you're fascinated with the persona and life and thought of Wittgenstein. Why didn't you write an intellectual book? I mean, what's the point of your turning to a fiction, a narrative storytelling, rather than biography? I mean, what's the difference? And why did you make that choice as a creator?
Well, for me, I like to write about philosophers. For me, philosophy is a glorious subject. It's a very difficult subject. It's a subject which I greatly admire people who pursue this area. And for me, fiction is a way of attesting to this admiration. One of the things that really interests me about these philosophers, great philosophers like Wittgenstein, is the absolute seriousness of their vocation. They're not sure what it is they're being called to do. They never quite feel they've arrived. They feel the need to start over, to make a fresh beginning, a fresh assault on the old problems. They have a burning sense of the importance of their topic. And this, for me, shows a great integrity. And to turn this into fiction is to ask the question about what does that kind of integrity mean today? What kind of example does such a person set? How might such a person be received in the contemporary university?
So you can explore... You could tell a story of Wittgenstein's mental, emotional life, of his struggles, through biography, but there's something you can't do. You can't really make vivid and powerful a counterfactual question about Wittgenstein, and making that counterfactual question vivid and powerful has a point. I mean, it has some kind of communicative point, because it gets us to see things. I mean, I'm trying to see if you would agree with this. It sounds like you think it gets us to see things about Wittgenstein that we otherwise couldn't see except through this fictive engagement. Is that get you right?
I think you put it absolutely right. That's quite perfect. The idea of a counterfactual and reflection on Wittgenstein perhaps leading to a genuine way of dealing with Wittgensteinian ideas in our times.
Now, there is an impressive intellectual biography of Wittgenstein by Monk. And frankly, he comes off as a bit of a jerk. Does he come off better in your novel than he does in Monk's biography?
Wittgenstein was someone who never really was aware of the influence that he had on other people. He was naive. Although he was a man of great integrity, it could be argued, I think, quite plausibly, that he misled his students, that he led them down the garden path, that he took them where he shouldn't have taken them, that he convinced some of them to give up their careers in academia and go and work in the local Woolworths, the local engineering firm, and he was damaging in many ways to his young admirers. Well, my Wittgenstein, the character Wittgenstein Jr. in my novel, is working in a very different context. And I think he's less dangerous in that sense. He's not someone who has such an extreme influence on the life of his pupils. They're not going to follow everything he says and everything he does. The students in my novel are more amazed that someone could take anything seriously at all. Because those students are very frivolous, they're foolish, they don't take anything seriously.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. It's our 10th annual summer reading show. We're talking to Lars Eyre, author of Wittgenstein Jr., a novel.
Lars, Wittgenstein Jr. is definitely on my summer reading list, and I'm sure on a lot of our listeners. What else are you going to be reading this summer? Give us a couple suggestions before we say goodbye.
And I'm particularly interested in things that do philosophy in a creative mode, in a different mode.
Yes, yeah, certainly. Now, there is a contemporary philosopher who died very young. Her name was Gillian Rose. She died, I think, in the mid-90s at the age of 48. She died very young, just when her work was really, really getting going. Well, her last two works, and these are two works I want to recommend to your listeners, the last two works are very intriguing because I think these are both works of what we might call wisdom literature. The first one is called Love's Work, which I think has been republished by New York Review of Books. They got a classics list, and they published that. It's really an account of her life as a thinker, an account of someone who has sought to live an ethical life in the contemporary world. And in each of the chapters, we meet some of the individuals with whom she's been involved in her career as a thinker.
Wow, that sounds interesting. Love's Work by Gillian Rose, and you said there was a second one by her.
Yeah, and this one's harder to get, and it's really only a fragment. It's called Paradiso. And, you know, Gillian Rose was dying of cancer as she was writing Love's Work, and she was... You know, she unfortunately died before she completed Paradiso. But what you find in this wonderfully fragmentary autobiography are these concisely sketched episodes: her friendship with a scholarly nun, her meeting with cancer doctors, her participation in a wedding ceremony. And these are interwoven with these wonderful lapidary meditations on theological and philosophical matters.
Wow. This also sounds cool. I mean, you know what sounds cool about it to me is it's a philosophical mind living a life, using that philosophical mind of hers to narrate this life and to do philosophy in the narrating of a life. So it brings so many different things together, and we so seldom see philosophy done in that mode.
Well, this is the idea of the ancient Greeks. It's that wonderful idea that what philosophy was, it's not an academic subject, it's a way of living. And what the person who's called the philosopher, who deserves that honorific, who deserves that title, is someone who lives their life in accordance with their teachings. And that's what Rose, in her autobiographies, seems to point towards. That's what she seems to claim that she's doing in her life. And I think the claim, when you read the autobiographies, is really quite plausible.
Well, Lars, this sounds really fascinating. I love your book. So thank you so much for joining us, Lars.
Thank you very much indeed for having me.
That was Lars Eyre from Newcastle University. He's the author of Wittgenstein Jr., a novel. You're listening to Philosophy Talk, and today we're putting together our annual summer reading list.
What's on your list? How about a little poetry this summer? After the break, we'll talk to a friend of the show who's got both a new book of poetry and a new book about poetry.
A poetic conversation with Jane Hirschfield when Philosophy Talk continues. Welcome back to the program. It's the summer reading list edition of Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're compiling a list of thought-provoking books for thoughtful people like you to read this summer.
Joining us in a moment is not a poetry man, but a poetry woman, Jane Hirschfield, an award-winning and deep-thinking poet who's got a pair of new books for the summer.
But before we talk with Jane directly, she recites a poem for our roving philosophical reporter, Shuka Kalantari. Shuka wants to find out how poetry affects the brain. she files this report.
For a few days only, the plum tree outside the window shoulders perfection. No matter the plums will be small, eaten only by squirrels and jays, I feast on the one thing, they on another, the shoulders.
In a study comparing poetry and prose, scientists discovered that poetry activates regions
of the right brain associated with introspection, human awareness, and thoughtfulness, specifically the posterior cingulate cortex.
That's according to a study from the University of Exeter.
Poetry also activates the medial temporal lobes.
We use those to store long-term memories.
As the plum's blossoms do not hear the bee, nor taste themselves turned into storable honey by that sumptuous disturbance.
Research shows that poetry is like music for the brain. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kantari.
Poetry. Turns out it not only makes you feel good to read, it's also good for your brain. Thanks, Shuka.
We're joined now by Jane Hirschfield. She's an award-winning poet with two new books, a collection of poems entitled The Beauty, and another book called 10 Windows, How Great Poems Transform the World. Jane, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
I'm very happy to be here.
So, Jane, let's start with your book of poetry, The Beauty. Tell us about that.
Okay. So there's a group of poems at the start of the book, all of whose titles begin with the word my. And before this big normal-sized book came out, there was a letterpress chapbook done, which had a title with a homonym in it, minus, M-Y-N-E-S-S, and then minus, M-I-N-U-S. So using the same sounds to talk about the dearness and the cherishing of the world and of the self which takes care of the world. But then the other side, the minus subtraction side, the provisionality and the transience and the unfixedness of the self and the way we are permeable and part of and continuous with all the rest of existence. And, you know, that kind of back and forth is very much what I think poetry brings to its investigation of the world, which is parallel to a philosophical investigation, but also in some ways is an expansion of it, or even, if I might be provocative, an antidote to it.
An antidote to philosophy? You sound like Wittgenstein. Why would we need an antidote to philosophy?
Well, a correction to a certain tendency, which I'm in a way, I'm setting up a straw man here, I know. But if one thinks of philosophy as a measured, detached, occasionally transcendent-leaning way of looking at things, a stepping back, an attempt to get outside of the self, poetry is doing the exact same thing, but almost always from inside the sense of here we are in our perishable bodies with our frail psyches and our foibles and our dearness, and we're doing the same thing. We're still trying to lead the examined life, but poetry is always doing it with a certain fidelity to the particular rather than the general, the lived rather than the abstract.
Now, your book, the title is The Beauty. If the title was Beauty, I'd know what to expect, poems about beauty. But The Beauty suggests you, you know, have some particular beauty in mind, you know, maybe Carmen Diaz or or Ken or
oh dear, no.
So what is the word beauty supposed to suggest?
The beauty of it all, including there's a marvelous line from one of the poets I'm going to be recommending later on. Thomas Tranströmer, the great Swedish Nobel poet who died just a couple of months ago. And the poem ends, existence, it's beautiful slag. And so, you know, that the slag heap, that the abandon, that the thing that you weren't mining for is equally beautiful and to be treasured and valued. That's the kind of beauty that I was thinking of. I think of part of poem's work in our human lives is to find the beauty in what is ordinarily thought unbeautiful, plain or boring or difficult or to be avoided. And one of the ways that poems help us to navigate our lives, as philosophy helps us to navigate our lives, is by giving us a way to see those things differently, to, instead of attempting to flee or avoid them, which is in any case impossible, to say yes to them. And part of how you do that is by finding the beauty in grief.
You said your other book is about poems that change the world.
Yeah, I'm interested in this other book, Jane, and give me your favorite example of a poem that changed the world and how it changed it.
I will tell you an example of another great poet's theory about how poems change the world, because it's such an enticing story. Czesław Miłosz, the great Polish earlier Nobel laureate, 1980 laureate, he said that he held Whitman responsible for the First World War, because
wow,
all of the young revolutionaries of Europe had been reading Walt Whitman and were instilled with the heated desire for a changed world and a democracy and the vision that Whitman was putting forward, and that it was those revolutionaries reading Whitman which led to all the rest.
I wonder, Jane, I've wondered about stuff like this before.
Yes.
Are there poets, are there artists who have that kind of deep political, I mean, and that's a large-scale political ambition for art. And I often think one of the things that has happened to art is it's lost that kind of sweep and scope. And do you think I'm right about that, or I'm just wrong about that?
Oh, I think that there are many ways of being an artist, and there are many ways of being consequential. And I think equally, poets who are simply working deeply, privately, just to express their lives as they feel them, can also change the art, change our worldview. Not just the big ambitious poems, but the small private poems are terribly important and needed. It's really useful to remember that the Chinese poets who went to jail or risked jail during the 1989 Tiananmen Square events were poets who were writing about their personal lives. That was, in fact, the transgressive act in China in 1989, to write a love poem. So they were changing the world from a required art of social responsibility and writing on behalf and towards and in favor of the state, to say, look, private life matters. Individuality matters.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. It's our 10th annual summer reading show, and we're talking to poet Jane Hirschfield.
So you got any suggestions for, you know, suppose we have a poetry glutton out there, or not maybe a poetry glutton, who wants to spend some time this summer with a good book of poetry. Got some suggestions?
Okay, so I have three recommendations for you. The first is a newly published book by Wisława Szymborska, the Polish 1996 Nobel winner. She died not very long ago, so this is her posthumous collected and last poems. It's titled Map. And Szymborska is our great poet of practical and pragmatic inquiry. She's always investigating the world. And the discovery that she arrives at very often in many of her poems is some combination of a kind of ethical recalibration, because she's looking at the world from a different point of view. One of her earlier collections was called View with a Grain of Sand, or View from a Grain of Sand. So she actually investigates existence from the point of view of a grain of sand lying on a windowsill. And also she arrives at, over and over again, the feeling of absolutely sheer astonishment. So her poems measure the failings we were talking about earlier, the messiness of human existence. They take stock of that, and they arrive again and again at a conclusion that I can only call astonishment, awe, compassion, and continuance. So one of her poems begins, "After every war, someone has to sweep up." And she's talking about the person, you know, in the aftermath with the broom, just taking the broken glass out of the out of the streets. And at the end of the poem, they're lying on the ground, chewing a blade of grass, looking up at the blue sky. D daydreaming.
So this sounds like a remarkable poet and a remarkable collection, and her most full, mature work, right? It sounds like, so that's a great suggestion. Briefly mention the other two.
So the other two poets I'd like to recommend are both Swedish poets. One is Thomas Tranströmer, who I mentioned earlier, who died just a couple of months ago. And a lot of his poems can be looked at as almost a direct response to Wittgenstein's saying, whereof we cannot speak, we must remain silent. His poems speak very directly to what can be said in poems that language doesn't seem able to carry at all. Then the last poet I'd like to recommend is a less well-known but still living Swedish poet, Lars Gustafsson, who for 20 years was living here in America teaching philosophy at the University of Texas in Austin. And he is truly a great poet who we should have made better use of in the world of poetry while he was here in America. He doesn't do philosophy in verse, which would be a very foolish endeavor. What he does is present cases. He presents image, narrative, and detail, all of which take their seat firmly in the actual world of our lives and in our senses, and counterbalances in his poems the thinking of wisdom in the abstract with its continuous coexistence inside of our puttering and imminent and perishable bodies. I'll just tell you, one of my favorite poems of his is called Aristotle and the Crayfish. And it closes with he pulls out many years after his son and he have brought home some crayfish for an aquarium which have disappeared, he opens a volume of Aristotle, is reading about memory, and one of the crayfish is there dead and fragrant in the pages.
Now, for our listeners, we'll have a list of all of Jane's recommendations at philosophytalk.org.
So, Jane, this has been great talking to you again. I would love to have you back on the show for a full-length thing.
Thank you very much. Take care.
Jane Hirschfield, author of 10 Windows, How Great Poems Transform the World, and a collection of her own works entitled The Beauty. You're listening to Philosophy Talk, and we're compiling our annual summer reading list.
Now, our online community of thinkers is a great place to go find more suggestions. There's lots of thoughtful reading people there. And one of our regular contributors is on the phone right now.
Brian Van Norden is a professor of philosophy at Vassar College. He used to be a graduate student at Stanford University. At Vassar, he also teaches in the Department of Chinese and Japanese.
Brian, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you very much, Ken.
So, Brian, I understand you've got a summer reading recommendation right from your own field of study, Chinese philosophy.
I do, yeah. My recommendation is the Zhuangzi, which unfortunately is a little hard to spell. It's Zhuangzi. And it's the translation I recommend is by Burton Watson by Columbia University Press. Zhuangzi is considered one of the founding figures of Taoism. And as you probably know, Confucianism, Taoism, and Buddhism are the three great philosophical and religious traditions of China.
I don't think I know the Zhuangzi. I know the Lao Tzu, is that right?
That's right. The Lao Tzu, also called the Tao Te Ching.
So tell us a little bit about the Lao Tzu and Confucius, which I've read, and Mencius. They all write in kind of aphoristic styles. Mencius writes in longer aphorisms. But is this also a kind of aphoristic thing that you can dip into and out of?
You can certainly dip into and out of it. Zhuangzi is a master of a lot of different styles. So he'll tell you short stories. He'll give you, you know, one or two page philosophical arguments, but written in a very lively style. He'll give you dialogues. But you can just pick it up almost anywhere and start reading and have a lot of fun with it. I find that students usually fall in love with it whenever they read it.
So this is good summer reading because you don't have to, like, sit down. It's not like reading Proust, right?
Right. It's one of those rare books where you can read it really carefully and spend a lifetime studying it, or you can just pick it up, read a few paragraphs, and have a good time and walk away with something interesting.
Are some of the philosophical problems he discusses ones familiar to us who've read, you know, Descartes and Hume and those kinds of guys?
They are. So, for example, some parts of the text, Zhuangzi argues for skepticism, and he does talk about dreams, and so one of the most famous passages in the Zhuangzi, it's an eponymous text, it's named after its supposed author. Zhuangzi says that he was dreaming that he was a butterfly and flittering around and having such a good time, and then he woke up, but in the moment he woke up, he wasn't sure whether he was Zhuangzi, who had just dreamed he was a butterfly, or was he a butterfly who was now dreaming he was Zhuangzi?
So now this Chinese, ancient Chinese philosophy, that's your professional field. You study that.
Is, yeah.
You love that stuff.
I do.
Okay. Why, tell me, why should I or anybody as a contemporary Western thinker steeped in 21st century thought, why should I care about what these old dead Chinese thought?
Well, I think one of the interesting things about Chinese philosophy is the way that it includes what really is a systematic kind of thought with an emphasis on how you can get to be a better person in a broad sense of better. So it's similar to Aristotelianism or Platonism or ancient Western philosophy in that it's not merely theoretical but is also concerned with how you could live your life differently. So, for example, although Zhuangzi's therapeutic, there's a point to the therapy, which is Zhuangzi wants to say, look, you can't drop out of the world, because whatever you do, you're going to have to be involved in the world some way or the other. If you drop out, you're just dropping into a different context. But he says when you learn to let go of your commitment to the truth of various claims, you'll be able to approach life in a more relaxed way and in a more flexible way. Well, and even if he's not right, it's an interesting suggestion for us as philosophers to consider.
Well, I agree it's an interesting suggestion. Repeat the suggestion.
So the suggestion is Zhuangzi, and the translation I like is Zhuangzi Basic Writings by Burton Watson from Columbia University Press. Zhuangzi is Zhuangzi. Trust me, you pick it up. All my students love it. You'll love it, too.
Okay, I'm going to go straight to Amazon and order a swimsuit and that book, and I'll be set for the summer. Thanks a lot, Brian.
Thank you, guys. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. It's our 10th annual summer reading show.
Hoping to fall in love this summer, or at least think deeply about love? In our next segment, we'll hear from a philosopher with a new book on the philosophy of love.
More summer reading picks from our special guest and you when Philosophy Talk continues.
One day I read a book, I can't remember when, but one of these days I'm going to do it again, yes, sir. One of these days I'm going to do it again.
Welcome back. It's our 10th annual summer reading show. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor.
Next, we're going to think about summer romance. There are many, many ways to say I love you. We sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shuka Kalantari, to see how people across the globe say I love you. She files this report.
Je t'aime. Naan unne kaadali kirin.
Bahabak.
Tu se taram.
ਮੈਂ ਤੈਨੂੰ ਪਿਆਰ ਕਰਦੀ ਆ
ਇਹਦੀ ਕਾਰਨ
ਸੇਨ ਸੇਵਿਓਰਮ
ਟੀ ਆਮੋ
ਇਨ ਸਪੇਨ ਦ ਬੈਸਟ ਅਪਰ ਸੈਟਸ ਡੂ ਇਟ ਲਿਥੁਆਨੀਅਨਸ ਐਂਡ ਲੈਟਸ
ਮੈਂ ਤੁਮਸੇ ਪਿਆਰ ਕਰਦੀ ਹਾਂ
ਲੈਟਸ ਡੂ
ਤਨੇ ਪ੍ਰੇਮ ਕਰੋ ਛੋ
ਲੈਟਸ ਫਾਲ ਇਨ ਲਵ
ਦੇ ਬੈਸਕ
ਬੌਂਗਸ ਰੋਲਾਂ ਓਨ
ਦ ਡਚ ਇਨ ਓਲਡ ਐਮਸਟਰਡਮ ਡੂ ਇਟ
ਡੋਂਟ ਯੂ ਸੀ ਵਾਟ ਆਮ ਟ੍ਰਾਈਂਗ ਟੂ ਟੈਲ ਯੂ ਆਈ ਲਵ ਯੂ ਵਾਈ ਡੋਂਟ ਯੂ ਮੈਰੀ ਮੀ
ਵਾਈ ਮੈਰੀ ਯੂ
ਯੂ ਟੇਕ ਮੀ ਐਂਡ ਆਈਲ ਟੇਕ ਅ ਵਕੇਸ਼ਨ ਆਈ ਨੀਡ ਅ ਵਕੇਸ਼ਨ ਇਫ ਵੀ ਗੋਇੰਗ ਟੂ ਗੈਟ ਮੈਰੀਡ ਗਲੋਰੀਆ
What are you thinking of?
I suppose you'll think me a sentimental old fluff, but would you mind giving me a lock of your hair?
A lock of my hair? Why, I had no idea.
I'm letting you off easy. I was going to ask for the whole wig.
Jenny, I'm sorry. Don't. Love means never having to say you're sorry.
Let's fall in love.
ladies and gentlemen, my unlimited love to y'all.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kantai.
The Many Languages of Love, a dispatch from our roving philosophical reporter.
We're joined now by Britt Brogard. She's a professor of philosophy at the University of Miami. She writes about perception, consciousness, and the emotions. And she's got a new book, Unromantic Love, Simple Truths About a Complex Emotion. Britt, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
So, Britt, give us a little taste of what people might learn about love in your book.
I argue against the mainstream philosophical view that love is not an emotion, that it is an emotion, and that it's love is love for a reason, and also it's responsive to reasons, which is a controversial idea. I also argue that there's such a thing as unconscious love, that love can come in degrees, and that you can take steps to fall into love or out of love.
You know, the thing about emotions, Britt, is I'm angry today, I'm happy tomorrow, I'm sad today, my emotions come and go. I can have lots of emotions. Take my wife. I love my wife. I've been married to her for 30-some years. My emotions toward her come and go, but my love endures throughout all those emotions.
Yeah.
Love doesn't seem like an emotion. It doesn't seem episodic. That's a word we philosophers use, but an episode is something that starts at a certain time, lasts for a certain time, and ends. Emotions are very episodic. Love doesn't seem episodic. It doesn't seem like the right kind of thing to be an emotion. What do you think of
love,
that?
Love is very similar to the other emotions. You can have anger, resentment for a very long time and carry it for years and years, or it might be something that just lasts 2 minutes. Sometimes love just lasts 2 minutes. It doesn't have to be long-lasting. In fact, I'm a little doubtful that love can last as long as you say it can last if it's romantic. Of course, there are other forms of love, but romantic love lasts a couple of years.
You think of that line from Shakespeare, "Love is not love which alters when it alteration finds." Right? You don't think there's something about a kind of enduring love that is more stable than a mirror. I mean, just think about something.
Yeah, that's what I call attachment love. Attachment love is different. This is the kind of love you can have for your dog.
the kind of love you can have for your dog.
So, Britt and Ken, I mean, come on. Love is a word that people that didn't know anything about the brain invented to cover a whole bunch of stuff, and then poets incorporated into literature. It would be a miracle if it really stood for some unitary biological state, wouldn't it? I mean, aren't you guys just barking up the tree of an illusion?
No, I think that there are, of course, many different forms of love. Friendship love is different from the love you feel for your child. Love for a romantic partner is different from lust. I even take lust of a certain kind to be a kind of love. And there are other forms of, like, altruism is a form of love. So there are different kinds of love. So love, the word love is polysemous. It has many different meanings.
So what distinguishes romantic love as an emotion from friendship love or attachment love or whatever other kinds of love you think there are? Just help me distinguish among
them. At the level of the mental state, it has to do with what it's like, so the phenomenal feel of it. At the level of the brain, it's different kinds of neurotransmitters that are involved in, for instance, attachment love and new romantic love. So new romantic love is more like a mental disease, whereas attachment love is more like this stable feeling you have after a four-course dinner when you're sitting back in your chair and feeling full.
So, you know, you have a view about love. Yes. And I'm sure you think it's the truest view about love.
You have to think that.
Yeah, that's part of a professional hazard, right? But there's some other views out there. And if somebody wanted to sampling for this summer reading, if they really wanted to plunge in to the philosophy of love, what's a couple things you'd recommend?
Helen Fisher, she has a book called The Anatomy of Love, which is an interesting contrast, where she argues that love is a drive. It's a stronger drive than the sex drive. And she also has other observations, such as that antidepressants are a threat to love because they actually stabilize serotonin levels and kill the dopamine off. So you will have trouble falling in love if you take antidepressants.
That sounds like such an unromantic theory of romantic love. You know?
Maybe that's it. Well, if you want more romantic theories, there's Love's Vision, which is more sort of in line with my book. So Troy Duly Moore's Love's Vision, where love is a singling out of a person's value by paying special attention to them. So you pay special attention to qualities the person already has, and other people don't love the same person that you do because they don't pay that special attention to those qualities. And lots of different factors can figure into this: availability, proximity, and timing, and so on. And if you want a more contrasting view, there's also this French writer, Pascal Bruckner, The Paradox of Love, where he argues that free love is an oxymoron. So basically, he thinks that love means attachment. And if it means attachment, then it cannot be free. So he's attacking the ideas of the 1960s. So the 1960s were based on a mistake.
Oh, wow.
Open relationships are not possible. Jealousy is too strong of a force, and so on.
Well, that sounds like a fascinating book, kind of a conservative.
So it's kind of conservative in the sense that he thinks that, that you get into this paradox that you want love to be free, but they can't be free because you can't have a love without an attachment.
So there's your book, Unromantic Love. There's Troy Duly Moore's Love's Vision. There's Helen Fisher's book, The Anatomy of Love. And this last one, what was this last one again?
Pascal Bruckner, The Paradox of Love.
Is your book the kind of book people want to take to the beach in the summer and read, along with maybe a couple of Harlequin novels that exhibit what you're talking about?
Yeah, there's philosophy in it, but there's a lot more in it as well. So, yeah, it's definitely good, and lots of sun, some cool drinks.
Okay, yeah, so, Britt, there's a lot more we can talk. Maybe we'll have you on the show, and we can talk about love for a whole hour. But right now, I can just thank you for joining us, okay?
Thanks, Britt.
Well, thanks so much for having me. Who wrote the book of
love? Britt Brogard from the University of Miami with some suggestions for anyone interested in the philosophy of love. We're compiling our annual summer reading list here on Philosophy Talk.
Let's turn to another member of our online community of thinkers, Philip in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, John and Ken.
So you got a summer reading suggestion for us, I hear.
Yes, it is Stephen Crane's third novel entitled The Third Violet.
The Third Violet.
Yes, it is his third novel. As I said, his first was Maggie, Girl of the Street. Second was Red Badge of Courage. In the third novel, he's dealing with romantic questions. The protagonist is a painter. Crane had quite a few painter friends, and as many people know, used a lot of color in his, not only the titles of his books, but in his imagery. And in The Third Violet, the protagonist, Hawker, is struggling with romance in the sense of, there's a model who's very attracted to him down in New York City, who he shuns. Half the novel is set in Manhattan, half is set in Sullivan County, New York, where Stephen Crane actually spent time. And he has a crush on this society girl who's vacationing from Massachusetts.
Now, Philip, I want you to do something. I'm a philosophy nerd. Pitch this to me as a philosophy nerd.
Well, Third Violet basically asks the question, if you're a serious artist, why should you be bothered with romance?
Ah, so there's a conflict between art and romance? Is that what's the conflict between art and love? I would think they feed each other.
For Stephen Crane, at age 25, he maybe had premonitions that he didn't have long to live because he did die at 28.
Wow.
His character, who seems to be the mouthpiece for Crane himself, he's very frustrated by it because, as he said to his friend Hollanden, I feel like an iron dog when I'm in the presence of this woman who he is infatuated with. He seems unable to relax into the romantic persona, and so he's very frustrated by it.
So when he's around this woman, he doesn't say anything and doesn't move and doesn't exude charm and just screws the whole thing up. I find that a familiar enough situation.
So the character, I take it, in the novel is himself an artist, right?
Yeah, he's a painter.
So is his artistic creativity enhanced or diminished or challenged somehow because of this relationship?
I'd say actually it's enhanced and diminished in the sense of when he's with her, he can't be that romantic ideal that he sees himself as because he feels like that iron dog. He feels clumsy. He feels shut up in his own limitations. But then when he's away from her, you know, I feel like it fuels his artistic ideals.
So this is a story, possibly. So there's a story of Gauguin who left his wife and his kids, abandoned his family for the sake of his art. And philosophers have been debating this kind of thing for a while. Whether, and he became a great artist, and somehow the trampling of the other, the little people, was instrumental to his becoming a great artist because, you know, ordinary domestic tranquility and all that may not be consistent with the unbridled pursuit of one's creativity. It sounds like similar themes are kind of running through this. But, you know, my own view about people like Gauguin is that they're just jerks, but... I don't really see them as paragons of creativity. I'm not sure if I think the same thing about Stephen Crane. You know, he died at the tender age of 28. Maybe he would have grown up and learned to embrace the people in his life rather than trample them. I don't know.
So, Philip, a couple of details. How long is this book?
It's about 145 pages. It's set during the summer, which might be an added bonus.
So, one could read it on one long afternoon at the beach if you had enough suntan lotion and weren't too busy doing other things.
Absolutely. In fact, in the second chapter, there's the exodus of New York. So he's escaping from New York, going up to Sullivan County. So there's this added element of it's vacation time.
Thanks a lot, Philip, for the suggestion.
Thanks, Philip.
Stephen Crane's The Third Violet.
Thanks, gentlemen.
Homework day shout is over and out. Vacation's just begun.
You can find all the books we've talked about on the show today, as well as many more suggestions from our listeners and guests, listed over at our community of thinkers at our website, philosophytalk.org.
Now, let's spend the dog days of summer with the fastest cat in the bookstore. It's Ian Scholes, the 62nd philosopher.
Ian Scholes. Anthony Lane reviewed the new biography of Lewis Carroll in The New Yorker, asking, quote, "Who reads the Alice books nowadays? Everybody knows Alice, but that is not the same thing," unquote. Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, again the original title, may not be read as much, but Alice is everywhere in Western culture. There was a bloated movie just 5 years ago with Australian actress Mia Wasikowska as Alice and Johnny Depp as the Mad Hatter. Tim Burton directed it. It made $1 billion, literally. Burton said in an interview about the book, quote, "It was always a girl wandering around from one crazy character to another, and I never really felt any real emotional connection," unquote. So, his movie ends with Alice picking up a vorpal blade and doing battle with a Jabberwock, called the Jabberwocky in the movie for no apparent reason. So, basically, Tim Burton turned Alice in Wonderland into a teenage girl warrior killing monsters. Apparently now the go-to gal when it comes to playing literary heroines, Mia went on to play Jane Eyre and Emma Bovary. Johnny Depp went on to play Tonto, thus spoiling another childhood favorite while diminishing none of the racism. Thank you, Johnny Depp. What about Sherlock Holmes, speaking of another Victorian, Edwardian literary holdover? Do people still read Sherlock Holmes? He's certainly everywhere. Holmes is now in the public domain. You can do anything you want. Robert Downey Jr. played him. Benedict Cumberbatch, with Holmes on the Twitter and the smartphone. Johnny Lee Miller in the American TV series Elementary, with Watson as a woman. You could even say the TV show House, with Sherlock in a hospital. Most of the Sherlock clones are set in the present day, except for the Robert Downey Jr., but that still put a distinctly steampunk spin on things, more Iron Man Avenue than Baker Street. And what about Treasure Island? Do people still read that? We've seen all the movies, forgetting there was Robert Louis Stevenson, with some help from the illustrator Howard Pyle and later Robert Newton as Long John Silver, who all gave us the pirates as we know them. Real pirates were psycho, killer, idiot drunks, like motorcycle gangs who didn't know how to drive. There were never any maps or buried treasure. No real pirate ever said "Arr." Now, we haven't had a remake of Treasure Island in a while, but we've had sequel after sequel of Pirates of the Caribbean, which is Treasure Island on steroids. And once again, Johnny Depp. What's the deal with that guy? Anyway, we still have these nods to a literary past, but is that past still, I don't know, viable? Or are we just surrounded by parodies, homages, pastiches, ghosts of things we used to enjoy? Why read Alice in Wonderland when you can read Tim Burton's novelization? Goodreads comment, quote, I think this book is better than the original. It modernized, unquote. Amazon comment, quote, I've read through it and find it entertaining and a pleasure to read. Don't let the number of pages fool you. It's a small book, unquote. American culture is so weird. I think of the sugar bear in the cereal ads, clearly doing a Bing Crosby impression. What does that mean to a five-year-old watching cartoons? Or the stork from the Vlasic Pickle ads, channeling Groucho Marx. Does anybody know who Groucho is anymore? Well, go ask Alice. I think she'll know. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2015.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Our marketing director is Dave Millar.
Thanks also to Ted Muldoon, Merle Kessler, Erica Topit, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.